All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. This is Chapter 5, Supplemental Episode 4, an interview with Rob Glaser. Rob was and is the founder and CEO of Real Networks. If you were around in the 90s, then you'll probably remember Real Audio and Real Video and the Real Media Player. In the age before broadband, Real Networks pioneered streaming media on the web. Quite simply, the early web would not have been multimedia at all without Real, and by the 90s, fully 85% of the streaming audio and video on the web was Real Media. But Rob was also an early Microsoft executive, so the interview starts out with Rob giving us some fascinating stories about being recruited to join Microsoft in the early 1980s, as well as his work with the successful relaunch of Microsoft Word and Excel in the mid-80s. One quick personal note here. Towards the end of this conversation, it may seem like I'm sort of rushing Rob off the air. Well, this was another case where I only had a specific and finite amount of time to speak with Rob. He's the CEO of a publicly traded corporation, after all, so his time is, of course, precious. This interview, in fact, took 2 months and 7 different reschedulings to pull off, so I'm grateful for the time that Rob was able to give us. Believe me, I would have spoken to him for as long as he would have gone on, but there were literally assistants over his shoulder making the wrap it up sign. But it's a fabulous oral history, and there's plenty of never-before-heard stuff in here, so enjoy Rob Glaser. Rob Glaser, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Great to be with you today.
Rob, I wanted to start off with going into a little bit of your background at Microsoft. Did you join Microsoft right out of college?
Basically, yeah. I took two degrees in 1983. One was a bachelor's degree in computer science, and the other was a master's degree in economics. I probably knew more about the PC than the average college grad in 1983 because I started my first company when I was in college. I worked for IBM in the summer of 1981, which by luck happened to be the summer the IBM PC was announced. And although I was not working in the geographic part of IBM that was associated with the PC, that was in Boca Raton, Florida, and I was in Poughkeepsie, New York. Turned out one of the members of the team that I was working at IBM was a PC hobbyist who was a sort of an extended member of that team. So after the PC came out, he was quite open about the history of the IBM PC project, and I got excited about it. So I got excited about PCs early on. I had not owned an Apple II or anything like that. I couldn't afford one, but I did program on my high school. We timeshared with the neighboring high school's mini computer, which was a DEC PDP 1134. So I'd done some interactive programming through that, and then I owned the computing device that I owned was a text instrument calculator. There was a programmable calculator with, I believe, 240 instructions in a binary opcode. So that had been the extent of my ownership of computers before, but I was doing a computer science degree, so obviously I knew a reasonable amount about how to program computers. And when the IBM PC came out, I got very excited about the PC. And it just sort of seemed to me, obviously more of a luck thing than a deeply informed thing, that this was going to be a big deal. And so with some friends, we wrote games, wrote two games. I wrote most of one, and a friend of mine wrote the other one and wrote some common libraries that we shared across the games. And there were four or five of us in the company. And that was my summer job for the summer of 82. So when I came time to graduate in the spring of 83, I was pretty sure I wanted to do something related to PCs, didn't know exactly what. Steve Ballmer and Paul Allen came from Microsoft to the Yale campus in the spring of 83. And I'd heard of Paul. I don't think I'd heard of Steve, since Paul was the co-founder of Microsoft, interviewed with Paul, as it turned out. And they asked me, along with a number of my other classmates, to come back to Bellevue, to Seattle area, for follow-up interviews. And so in middle of April of 1983, I did, and was offered a job, and I accepted it. And I started at Microsoft, I think it was June 15th, 1983, had a great 10-year run there.
And you were involved in some of the things, like the successful relaunch of the Word and the Excel platform, right?
Yeah, so I spent the first 4 years or so in Microsoft in the applications business, then a couple years in computer networking, and then about the last 3 or 4 years working on multimedia systems and the set advanced systems. So more on the product side of things than at the intersection of the technical and the product management and the business management product side. In my first year there, I was involved with some products that had been developed jointly by Microsoft and some outside parties. Probably the most famous one, although I didn't spend that much time on it, was Microsoft Flight Simulator. I was also involved with a project management product called Microsoft Project, which is one of these, several $100 million businesses inside Microsoft nowadays that kind of nobody knows about, just that's been plugging along for years. And I'll upstart and build that business within Microsoft. Then I was involved in a couple other products. And then in the summer of 84, I was asked to help relaunch Microsoft Word, and that was sort of the first kind of thing that Microsoft really cared a lot about, that I was asked to play a significant role in. And we were successful at taking Word from a kind of an also-ran position at the time. Now, this is back in the DOS world. This is before Windows and before Office.
Right.
But Word went from number five in the category to a pretty strong number two behind WordPerfect. And that was through a combination of product innovation and the right kind of marketing around it. The product was a brilliant piece of technology. A famous guy named Charles Simony had taken the word processing technology that he built at Xerox PARC called Bravo. Bravo X was the word processor, I believe. And Charles had come to Microsoft to do productivity applications based on graphical user interface, which, of course, was what the Xerox Star was the pioneer that all of the modern PC environments, be it the Mac or Windows, all heavily borrowed from the innovations at Xerox. And in fact, in the day, I remember one of the cool things, Microsoft had one of the original Xerox Stars, which sat up in a room, and it was, I don't know, it's like an $80,000 system or something, and it was incredibly slow, and it took about 20 minutes to boot, and I remember it took about 15 minutes to shut down. It was not anybody's current view of modern racks of computing from a lot of the implementation characteristics, but it had the mouse, it had the graphical interface, it had the bitmap display, and it had laser printer support. And that was highly relevant because Word was the first word processing product to really intrinsically take advantage of laser printers and to have internal resolution of the document be at the pixel level, really at the topography level, rather than at the typewriter type model that early word processors that were based on fixed size fonts were mostly focused on. So Word had a technical advantage that was quite deep in its bones, and we partnered with some of the early laser printer companies like the HP LaserJet to bring that to life. And between that and sort of smoothing out some of the rough edges of the product, we were able to bring it up to a strong number two position. So that I did that, and then I ran program management for all the applications. And then I got involved in the networking part of Microsoft, which was a fascinating lesson for me because it was worked with a great team of people who went on to do many, many important things within Microsoft and within the industry as a whole. But that project was not successful in its initial form because it was based on the OS2 operating system. So it was a suite of network products and services based on OS2. We had the LAN manager, we had a database product. So that was a very interesting learning experience. I learned a ton that ended up being super helpful during the growth of the internet and set us up, I think, well to do what became Real Networks.
Right.
But that was itself not a successful initiative, but we learned a lot. And then I spent the last 3 or 4 years working on what we called multimedia systems, which had two parts. Where one was sort of building all the multimedia subsystems, audio, motion, video, et cetera, that got put into Windows on the one hand, and then trying to create very early forms of derivative digital devices that were too way before their time, as it turned out, but we didn't know that at the time, to try to leverage a lot of the technologies that we had in different device formats, be it TV attached devices or be it small portable devices. And so I did that, those combinations for my last 3 or 4 years at Microsoft before deciding to pull the Periscope up in the spring of 1993.
Right. Well, that's my next question for you is, I believe you're exactly age 30 and you're the youngest at that point, youngest ever VP at Microsoft. So what made you?
I don't know, youngest ever because probably Bill and Steve gave themselves VP titles when they were 23, but I wasn't youngest at the time. And
right.
I'm guessing since, yes, that's right.
So what was it that made you want to put the Periscope up? As you say, was it just you got the entrepreneurial bug?
I would say it was three things. That's one. My dad started a company. He had a small printing company in New York, and I saw him run that company. He started it a year or two before I was born, and he ran it all my life until he retired, actually after I moved out to Seattle Microsoft. So he probably retired about 1990. And so I sort of saw his entrepreneurial experiences and just work in vacations and the like to help him out. So I kind of was sort of raised by an entrepreneur. We didn't call it that at the time. He was still a small businessman, but a similar thing. That's one thing. Second, when I joined Microsoft, I loved it. I had a great experience. When I got there, Microsoft was about a $50 million company in sales, about 250 people. It was fast. It was freewheeling. They give a kid in his 20s. I was 21 when I got there. As you said, I was 30 when Bill chose to make me a VP. So I was able to really do a ton, learn a lot, have a lot of great experiences. But by the early 90s, it was clear that Windows was ascendant. Windows 3.0 and 3.1 had shipped. All the technology, the multimedia stuff we built, became the foundation for all that stuff in Windows 3.1. Windows 95 hadn't shipped yet, but it seemed pretty clear that Windows was about to run the table in the next generation computer platforms. And I kind of was thinking, well, I may want to get involved with something more nascent, where there's more degrees of freedom to kind of move the meter. And then the third was that my interests were always more at the intersection of technology, media, and communications than just technology. Microsoft's an amazing company. As I said, I had 10 great years there. I've still many, many friends from that era. Some friends are still associated with the company. And it was a great run, but Microsoft was fundamentally, about a computer on every desk and in every home. And I was much more interested in the intersection between computing and communication and media. In addition to my computer stuff, I had started a radio station when I was in high school. I was editorial editor of the student newspaper in college. So I had this interest in media and communications as well. The stuff that I was, and I'd say to this day, 20 years later, interested in if you looked at the Venn diagram of my interest in Microsoft's focus at that time, there was significant overlap, but but it wasn't a bullseye. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll do something that's more of a bullseye if I start with a blank sheet of paper.
So is Progressive Networks, which is what the company was known before it became Real Networks, was Progressive Networks from the start an attempt to do communications and things on the web, or were you already rolling when the web sort of takes off, and so then it's sort of kismet?
Well, it was definitely kismet, but it wasn't completely random. So in the spring of 93, I left, technically did a leave of absence, which was what they asked me to do, and seemed like it would be fine to do it that way. I didn't think I was likely to come back. I ended up in the fall of 93, ended up doing a little consulting for Bill on a few projects that were hopefully helpful to them and certainly interesting to me, because it got me learning about some stuff that was interesting to me. But I had sort of two areas of focus. One was all this interactive TV stuff that people were talking about, and you wouldn't necessarily remember it now, but in the early 93, late 92, 93, there was all this hype about the 500 channel universe. Time Warner had this very significant experiment they were doing in Orlando, Florida.
Right, the full service network.
The full service network, exactly. Other cable companies, TCI, announced that they had put a purchase order to buy 1 million digital set-top boxes over the next year. Viacom, which at the time owned cable companies as well as media properties, were doing a big interactive trial in Castro Valley. So there was all of this hype around that world. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go learn about that world. And I also thought I'm going to learn about the future of online services. One of the other projects I built at Microsoft was called Microsoft Access, not the database product. It was an earlier use of the name, mm-hmm. and it was a communications product. And it automated communication for online services. So it was a combination of a serial communications product with a scripting language, so we could automate having scripting access to sort of create human interfaces for the likes of CompuServe. I believe we supported AOL, Prodigy, and the like. So I was sort of a fan of online communities and communication, you know, given my interest in that from as I mentioned earlier, from an earlier interest. I was kind of woven into that. So I thought, well, what's the future of the online world? And then I got very lucky in a funny chain of events. One of the friends I developed in business is this brilliant guy named Mitch Kapor, who may or may not have already been featured in your series. If not, he should be.
Right.
Total visionary guy who understood the importance of the web earlier than anybody I knew, and understood the importance of all of these social and public policy and community issues. Mitch had started a foundation called the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which was focused on these issues. And Mitch asked me if I would consider getting on the board of it. And I was at this point officially on leave from Microsoft, but not thinking I was going to go back. So I traveled abroad for a couple months. And then in late May, I think it was around Memorial Day weekend, I went to an EFF board meeting. And I think it was in Austin, Texas. That rings a bell. And at that meeting, one of the members of the EFF board, a guy named Dave Farber, crowded everyone around his laptop. I think it was a Mac. And he said, "Hey, you got to try this Mosaic thing." And so he showed us an early prototype of what was called NCSA Mosaic. Mm-hmm. And I had heard a little about the World Wide Web. I knew a bit about Waze and Archie and all of these things that were distributed hypermedia things. And in fact, one of the things that I worked on was hypermedia systems that were sort of HyperCard-like. They were single device hypermedia systems. And so the idea of distributed hypermedia had been out there for a long time, and I thought it was interesting. And literally, when he showed us this mosaic, I was knocked away. I was like, okay, I've just seen the future. And it was really lucky because, you know, I wasn't following research being done at the NCSA Supercomputer Center in Champaign-Urbana, but early web heads like Dave Farber, who was really one of the fathers of the internet. He was not at the Bob Connor Vint Cerf level of the IP protocol, but very early on in the original interconnectivity of academic research machines. Dave was a professor for many years at University of Pennsylvania. So Dave said, "You got to try this mosaic thing." It was like, okay, I've seen the future. So I came back from that And even though I still explored the interactive TV stuff and kind of let it play out, I decided, all right, I'm going to learn everything I can about this new online world. So I found a little ISP in Seattle that would let me set up a slip account. It was a TCP dial-in, little ISP called Halcyon. I got the phone company to put an ISDN, a dual-bonded ISDN line into my home so I could experience the dial-up web, not just at 14.4 speed or those hot new modems that were 28.8 at the time, but I could actually experience it at something like, you know, what would be early broadband speeds. You know, dual bonded ISDN was slow, but much faster than 14.4 or 28. I think it was like 128K or something. So I downloaded Mosaic, got all the stuff configured and set up. And it was like, all right, this is amazing. Because you go to the NCSA Mosaic site, and I've heard other people like Jeff Bezos, who saw the same thing in the summer of 93. And it was like watching massively rapid viral propagation. The once new NCSA Mosaic webpage would list what all the new sites people were building. And at first, when I got on, there'd be like two a week. Then there'd be like seven or eight a week. Then there'd be like two or three a day. And they were, most of them were research projects at an institution. Most of them weren't that commercial. It was clear that something magical was happening. And I thought, wow, how lucky is it that I happen to have my Periscope up at the dawn of a new communication medium? So this is now, you know, getting into the summer and fall of 93. I thought, well, how do we do for audio and video what the web browser is doing for text? And one of Mark Andreessen's innovations, which was a real innovation of Mark and the team at NCSA Mosaic, was the images tag.
Right.
So they've done this great thing for text and still images. How do we plug into that to add rich media, time-based media to that? And because I'd done all the multimedia infrastructure software, I knew a lot about audio and video compression. I knew a reasonable amount about network protocols. And so it seemed to me that we could do something impactful if we invented the right technology. And so I then, I would say by the late summer, early fall of 93, I felt like I was really onto something. At the same time, all this interactive cable TV stuff, I went and visited with people I'd gotten to know from at Viacom and Time Warner and TCI, and I reached the conclusion that that whole stuff was hype that was never going to matter because there was no technical or business bootstrap. All those people were working on vastly divergent architectures. Every set-top box had its own chipset, its own operating system, its own programming tools. And one of the things I knew from Microsoft is you needed cohesion and commonality to have application platforms that would have scale and sufficient robustness so you could build compelling applications and services. And so it seemed to me that whole interactive TV thing, while well-intentioned, was started by people individually and collectively who didn't understand. They were analog guys who understood the need to have, you know, modulation protocols for how you you allocate the spectrum or signal on a cable, but they didn't understand software architectures. So I reached the conclusion that that wasn't going to bootstrap, but at the same time that this whole, you know, TCP/IP based magical combination of TCP/IP, DNS and distributed networking, the HTTP protocol, and the web browser was this amazing self-replicating bootstrap machine. And so thought about, okay, how do we integrate time-based media into this? And so I pulled together, this is now into the late fall, early spring of 1994, I pulled together a team of some people who in one case, a guy I knew before, who was a friend of mine from Microsoft named Mark O'Brien, who had left Microsoft and was doing independent programming. He was moving around. He lived in Boston, then he moved to Michigan, then he moved back to Boston. I think he was still living in Boston at the time for the first go around. But Mark was someone wasn't one of my closest friends, and he knew Windows programming super well. And then I rummaged around through friends of friends and found, because I didn't want to take any Microsoft guys, because I was still affiliated with Microsoft, but through some people I knew at Microsoft, they knew somebody who was a audio codec expert. And we looked at various audio, we analyzed various audio codecs for both computational complexity, audio quality, and bit rate to try to see if there was a cocktail of existing technologies we could put together that would allow for streaming over of audio. Because one of the early conclusions I reached was that you want to do something that was real-time responsive, and so therefore streaming was going to be much more advantageous than downloading.
Could I just interrupt you real quick, because you never named the person. Was that Phil Barrett that you're doing this with?
No, Phil Barrett came later on.
Okay.
The first consultant we used, too, the first consultant was a guy named Randy Goldberg.
Okay.
He never became an employee. The two guys that had a long-term project involved with the project was a guy named Tom Boutel. And I met Tom because Tom was the moderator of the FAQ on WWW. Mm-hmm. And Tom was just a guy who was working at Cold Springs Harbor Research Lab in Long Island, who was a telecommuter, super smart guy, great guy. And I just started corresponding with Tom, and it turned out the guy knew more about the web than like anybody I could find. And he was not – his day job was doing programming for Cold Springs Harbor Research Facility, which was a government research thing. It was fine. But he had this huge passion about the web. So I said, hey, Tom, why don't you come out to Seattle and help help build a distributed web system for media delivery? So Tom actually relocated to Seattle. Was one of our very, very first employees. Then by the sort of the spring, early summer, just me and those three guys, we got a demo to the sort of the Watson, come here, I need you, that showed that if you had a computer and you dialed into it with a 14.4 modem and you clicked on a hyperlink, we could do direct real-time streaming of that audio into, at that point we had a client, we did a web plugin later, into a client that was it was invoked from a link from an HTML link in the web browser. So you see a link in Mosaic, you click on it, it brings up a little client software on a Windows computer, and it real-time streams the audio.
And because the key is, as I interrupted you before, is because bandwidth being what it was, it has to stream. There's not the ability to do downloads. They would take, you know, 12, 24 hours or whatever. So you have to be able to stream it as close to real time as possible.
Yes, we made three or four what turned out to be important technical decisions. The first was to do streaming rather than full downloading. At the time, there were a few people that were putting audio files up. There was Iuma, I think, may have been up already. I forget when Iuma went up. There was Carl, I'm spacing on his last name. Should have prepped for this interview better, who had an internet audio talk archive that was Carl Malamud. It was an important public service thing. He would take audio of public events and the like and do interviews with them, and he put them up. And those were downloaded, and they were compressed audio, but they were still full file downloads. So one of the decisions was hey, we got to stream it, which meant inventing a streaming protocol, which we did. One of the decisions was, let's do audio first. Let's delay video. While video was sexy and exciting, and I'd done digital video at Microsoft, I knew that the bit rates required to do video well were not really compatible with dial-up, and certainly not 14.4 or 28.8 modem bit rates. And then the third thing, which we kind of came to later on, is when we looked at the codecs we were able to use and the bit rates we were able to get, they really didn't handle polyphonic content very well. So we decided to focus more on voice content for Real Audio One. We quickly moved to music. It was the next, you know, 6 months to a year. And when you got up to 56K modems or even 28.8, you could do higher bitrate music codecs that work. But the very, very first ones, the Watson, come here, I need you, were 8 kilobit kelp variant codecs that were really good on simple signals but didn't handle polyphonic audio very well. And so that was those set of design decisions turned out to be fortuitous, good, take your pick. Because they aligned us with something that could really, when the web turned commercial next year or so, deliver a much, much better experience than people who were probably had bigger research teams than us, but they were sort of trying to solve the general problem rather than a more useful specific subset.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And how soon are you able to get it inside the browser as opposed to being a separate client?
So what happened was, so we had this prototype, and I was pretty careful who I showed it to, because I figured we had something pretty significant. So I showed it to Mitch Caper, because I feel like he's a good friend. I trusted him, super smart guy. And also, he had connected me up to the guys who sort of first saw the first web browser. And Mitch thought this was great. He said he was interested in being helpfully involved. This is now sort of the summer of 94. And then I said, all right, let's go for it. So I had been fortunate at Microsoft, and then I had been there early and before the company was public. And so I had some resources that I could put aside. And so I said, let's build a little team here. We had Tom, I mentioned, Mark O'Brien was working remotely. At some point we switched out the compression guy to get somebody who could move to Seattle and be in core in the team there. Then a crucial hire in the fall of 94 was Phil Barrett, who was one of the best development heads I ever had a chance to work with at Microsoft. Super smart, but also a very practical guy. And Phil and I had stayed in touch when I left Microsoft, and it just turned out that he was open to making a change at the time, which I'm eternally grateful for, because, you know, we're like a four-person company at the time, and, you know, it was a pretty gutsy thing for Phil to take that leap of faith, and Phil did. And then he joined us, and he built out the engineering and product team, and then we recruited a couple more folks, and at this point it was clear we were onto something. We did, in early 1995, we raised a little bit of money, a couple $1 million from some angels. Mitch Caper led the round, so we'd have enough money to launch. At that point, I thought we really had something pretty amazing, and kind of wanted to get it out and see what happened. You asked about the browser integration question. Mm-hmm. So in the fall of 94, which is where I first met Mark Andreessen, there was a second or third worldwide rep conference, was in Chicago, as I believe. And so I went there and with my little computer set up, and I showed this to Mark Andreessen. And I forget where Mark was at the time in terms of the steps of leaving NCSA and moving out to California and forming what was first called Mosaic Communications and became Netscape.
Right.
I think Mark had already left and was in California, but Mosaic Communications had either they announced there or they were showing it privately, but they hadn't announced. So I saw what was then being called the Netscape browser. I showed this streaming technology to Mark, and Mark got excited about it, and he said, "Yeah, I would love to support that. Let's implement a plugin architecture so we can support your audio player as a plugin to the browser." So the first discussions were between us and Netscape were in late 1994, early 1995, and then at the time we knew that Microsoft was also trying to get into the browser in a very significant way. So contacted some friends at Microsoft and obviously explained what we were trying to do, and And they also agreed that they would create a way for us to do a plug-in. So then we basically had pretty much everything we needed to launch other than content. So through some friends, one of the things we decided to do, which was also a good decision, was not just to launch a technology and hope that people could do something useful with it, but to actually build some apps ourselves and get some content. So we did two most significant deals were with National Public Radio and with ABC News, mm-hmm. Where they had content that was people would find compelling, but that was pretty time sensitive. So you would, NPR would do All Things Considered or Morning Edition or these shows, and they'd get broadcast once, and then they'd sort of disappear, even though they had really interesting archival value. ABC would do headline news, they'd do sports, and if you didn't happen to be listening on the top of the hour, you'd miss them. And so we did two-way deals with them where we licensed them our technology for them to use in any way they wanted, and we licensed their content so we could build applications that showcase their technology, their content, and our technology. So we pulled all this together. It was pretty frantic times. I remember, not getting a lot of sleep. And then in April of 95, we launched, there were at consecutive weeks, there was a broadcast show, National Association of Broadcasting. And then the same week or a couple days later, there was an internet conference in San Jose. So we launched Real Audio in that week in April of 95. And we were paranoid that we wouldn't be first because, by then the Netscape browser had shipped and it got a lot of attention. People were starting to talk about the internet, not just as a research thing, but as a commercial environment. The first early commercial companies of the internet were starting to come out. And so we felt like we were in a race to be not just to be the best, but to be the first with a good solution. We won that race. We launched in April of 95. We had the ABC 24/7 news available on demand. We had a bunch of the NPR content. We did satellite signal acquisition for both those content. Did the satellite, built the apps to integrate those. And at the same point, we launched a free player. We've always had a free player going back now 19 years, mm-hmm. ever since April of 95. Our initial idea was, we'll give away players, we'll give away encoders, and we'll sell the servers for broadcasting. And then we'll go from there.
So the Netscape model.
It was similar to Netscape model. Yeah. Netscape had a little bit of a variant in how they worked with enterprises, where they would sell a commercial license to the browser to enterprises. We ended up selling a premium consumer version of the Real Player, we call the Real Audio Player Plus,
right.
Starting in the summer of '96, I believe. But we didn't cleave it with enterprise versus consumer. We just did it free versus premium.
Right, and I know you have a hard out in terms of time here, so you guys do eventually do video in 97.
Yeah, I'll do the fast forward. So
sure.
Launched in 95, we knew we were onto something magical when in the first 48 hours, people had downloaded the product in like 25 countries around the world. I mean, we're at that point, I don't think we did 20 people. We had like 18, 20 people in Seattle. We had hired a head of internet ops who was a brilliant guy named Jerry Black, who we interviewed over the internet. He was based in Kwajalein in the Marshall Islands, and he managed to build internet connectivity in Marshall Islands. We figured anybody who can do that can probably build a pretty good internet stack and a service operation for us here in Seattle. So we thought we had a pretty scrappy way to build something that would hold up. And we distributed our players for free. First, had a basic version of the server, a trial version, but the main version of the server was a paid product, and launched that. Then, as I said, a year later, we launched the premium version of the player. And then a year after that, in 97, so about 2 years in, we launched Real Video, which was not the first video product, because a few other people followed on. But we'd like to think it was the first good one that actually worked, because we put the same level of attention and care to making sure that we could do. We technically supported dial-up on 56K modems, which was okay if the video was small and there wasn't too much motion involved. One of the things we did there is we actually hired Spike Lee to do a couple of short movies that would showcase this technology. He did an amazing job creating these great short films. I think you can still find them out there somewhere on the internet. I'll after this interview. It'll stimulate me to find where they are. I haven't watched them recently. But the one that was the craziest one was he said, I want to do a show about this great, the guy who created this show, Bring in the Funk, Bring in the Noise, this tap dancer named Saving Glover. Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing about that and thinking, how the heck are we going to compress the video so you'll actually be able to see the tap dancer over 56K modems? But it was a short enough clip, and we were able to do a little hand tuning on it. And so we were able to show the first short films that worked decently over 56K modem, and they really shined on ISDN or cable modems. And that was right at the time that the cable modem world, the DOCSIS standard came about. It was starting to be coalescence around broadband. So it was still in 97, it was early enough for us to stake out a real leadership position in video as well.
Right, and by the end of the 90s, something like 85% of all the audio and video on the net is basically served via real media, right?
You can count it lots of different ways. Certainly of the stream content, we had very high market share. There was obviously downloaded content, and there were other methods of content, but we really hit that hit the market quite nicely there in the period where standards like HI-264 weren't out there. The choices were only proprietary formats, and in that era we were the most popular format and delivery system by far.
If I could trouble you for one more question, most of the people I'm speaking to, the stuff we're talking about is exactly 20 years ago, and this is true for this sort of stuff as well. So now, 20 years on, especially with digital media, has it reached what you imagined it would be 20 years ago? Is it better? Has it not reached what you imagined yet? Or what do you think digital media is like today, based on what you were dreaming of 20 years ago?
So I would say we've made incredible progress, and obviously proud in our pioneering role in catalyzing that and getting the ball rolling. And, I ran Real for a little over 15 years, and then I left, and about 2 years ago I came back, and now we're reinventing Real Networks for the future, which is what I spend my day job on. The reinvention for the future is everybody basically is carrying a video camera and a video phone in their pocket. But we don't yet have a period of time where I can just pick up the phone and call you and have a video call like a voice call. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. So that one has taken longer than I thought. And yes, people use Skype, and there's a little bit of it, but we're not in the Dick Tracy period yet. And that one surprised me. Second thing is, video is still somewhat of a Tower of Babel, where you create a video on your phone, and it's not clear that you'll be able to get it across to all the devices you want. If you do, will it be a low res product version? Will it be a high res that'll take forever to deliver? So there's a bunch of work, and that's one of the main things we're working on with Real Player Cloud, to make video work seamlessly across devices. A third one is this whole Tower of Babel around digital rights management with video is still a mess. So if you buy a video on Apple, it won't play on a Google device. If you buy from Amazon, you can't play it unless you're on a device that has Amazon client support. If you buy on Google Play, you can't play it on an iPhone. So that kind of ridiculousness, I would have thought that there would have been either a consumer rebellion against or industry coalescence around better solutions. So there's a bunch of stuff that's magical. All of the phenomenon the aggregate of all of the YouTube content and all of the independent ways people can create, be their own broadcaster and reach very large audiences, all that stuff's great. But there's still a bunch of stuff around compatibility on the one hand and having video be in every part of everyone's lives where there's still meaningful work to do. And, it's one of the reasons that I'm back here at Real is we're tackling a bunch of those problems.
Well, Rob, thank you for taking the time to remember all this for us.
Well, it's fun. It's a little bit jarring the memories, and I think I got most of the names right. For the one or two that I didn't remember, I apologize for that. But, 20 years is a lot of water under the bridge.
If you're enjoying this podcast, there's one simple thing that you can do to help us out. If you do nothing else, just go to iTunes and rate us. one to five stars takes about 2 seconds. Or give us a review, because the weird way that iTunes works is it's not just the number of downloads, it's also the number of ratings and reviews. As always, you can join the conversation at www.internethistorypodcast.com. Get more info, see pictures, and see my full bibliography for each episode. The show's Twitter is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.